to Line of Sight. My name is Don Heider. I'm the Executive Director of the Markulis Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University.
And I'm Thane Kreiner, Executive Director of Miller Center for Social Entrepreneurship at Santa Clara University.
We're excited to have with us today Danil Lewin. Danil directs the strategic planning, fundraising, and ongoing operations of the Computer History Museum here in the Valley. Prior to the museum, Danil led Microsoft's work in applying technology for public good. During a 17-year tenure, he collaborated cross-company with external partners focused on scalable impact with a portfolio spanning campaign and civic technologies, affordable internet access, environmental sustainability, and collaboration with leading research universities. Danil has a 30-plus year experience of leadership in Silicon Valley with companies that include Next, Apple, Go Corporation, and Sony. Before joining Microsoft in 2001, he was the CEO of Origin Systems, a company that pioneered the market for intellectual property asset management. Danil, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Don. Thanks, Thane.
Can you talk a little bit first about how you got into the tech for good space and how you're seeing technology change the landscape for social justice?
Well, my interest in technology and technology for good goes back to, frankly, coming out of higher education and looking at out of college and looking at industries that piqued my interest. And it was my good fortune that at that moment in time, Silicon Valley was just becoming Silicon Valley, and that's where I ended up. My interest involved working with the university community and the Macintosh. I was part of the team that built the original Macintosh, and the first slide in our presentation to any audience was a picture of a Cuisinart. And the idea was that it could do many things. And the essence of it was this notion that it could be an amplifier for human potential. And there were some concepts around energy output and locomotion and movement. Humans were very far down on the scale, very inefficient in movement. But when you put a person on a bicycle, they outdid a condor, which had the most efficient energy output for distance travel. So I've always had an underpinning and an interest in technology as applied to human potential. But to fast forward, my last 5 years at Microsoft, I worked for Brad Smith, who's the president of the company, and set up a series of practices, as he called them. He's trained as a lawyer, so most things are practices. But they were initiatives to coalesce the company's interest in public-private partnerships for the greater good of technology as applied to sort of a more even distribution, given all the great things that technology has allowed for over kind of the 50-year reign, if you will, of the microprocessor-based revolution in technology. You know, that is the technique of applying digital capabilities to changes in structure. So I consider innovation to be changes in structure and technique to be the technology that drives those changes. So I had a really keen interest in what was going on, as did the company, in the technology space as it related to campaigning, and in particular the presidential campaign cycle going into 2016. So in 2012, I built a cornerstone initiative around campaign technology services, and then picked up one or two other small pieces of a portfolio, and then built out an array of activities inside of Microsoft that were all tied to the greater good and use of technology for human potential. So it was always my interest, and then I had this great good fortune in my last 5 years at Microsoft to actually build at the top of one of the most valuable companies in the world outreach and techniques to make that happen. So long-winded answer, but it was a long journey.
So Danil, one of the things that's really interesting to me, given your incredible history at, you know, the edge of technology innovation and how it's really transformed the way we communicate, especially as we think about in this time of pandemic when we're all working from home, it wouldn't have even been possible to imagine we could have these kinds of conversations virtually 15 years ago, maybe not even 10 years ago, with anyone anywhere in the world. And your role at Computer History Museum is really, I think, informative that technology through the lens of impacting social change. Can you tell us a little bit more about the strategy at Computer History Museum? And I'm going all the way back when you were talking about your time at Apple to my very first Mac and how it changed my life. And from there, we've made these incredible leaps forward where, you know, pretty much everyone in the world, not everyone, but pretty much everyone has access to a mobile phone now.
Yeah, that to me was a wonderful transition and a great opportunity. I had been friends with the trustees at the museum since inception. And frankly, the museum, although based in Silicon Valley for the last 20 plus years, had its roots back in Boston, going back into the early 1980s, where I actually went to the opening of the museum. One of the current trustees and founder of that Boston, the Computer Museum in Boston, is Gordon Bell and his wife, Gwen. Gordon's one of the pioneers of the computer industry at Digital Equipment Corporation. Sort of modern computing architecture as we know it came from Gordon's mind, and digital as a company. When the trustees asked me if I would consider running the museum, they had been without a CEO for a little while. One of the trustees had stepped in, and I stepped back and thought about it. I wanted to do something that I'd never done before. I like to change and sort of replant myself, sort of, you know, like a potted plant. It's like, okay, trim the root system a little bit and then go do something new. There were three things that I had in mind, and the first of which was the repositioning of the institution. It had been this incredible collector of all the artifacts and in most cases, the key oral histories from the pioneers of the industry. There are well over 1,000 oral histories in the inventory of the pioneers. And we have the original Fairchild notebooks from Fairchild Semiconductor. And there's just it is the definitive collection of computing artifacts and stories in the world. What we just came to after working over the course of the first year plus with the trustees is a focused repositioning and mission. And we concluded that as we go forward, that the museum's responsibility is to decode technology, its computing past, digital present, and the future impact on humanity to shape a better future. We build our tools, and then our tools shape us. I think that's Churchill or somebody like that, or maybe McLuhan. But the idea that computing in the very beginning was kind of contentless, if you will. It was, you know, manipulating numbers and drawing things and filling up databases with data. Our digital present, when you mention mobile phones, it makes me, you know, sort of speak to that our digital present is content rich. And the filtering and the process by which we engage with technology as this new generation grows up surrounded by computing is an ambient capability. It's in the woodwork. It's in the fabric. It's like electricity. It's like air. In fact, it's even more present than electricity because when you move around the world to consume electricity, for the most part, you have to have a different type of plug, right, in different parts of the world, a different physical connector. Internet protocol is like air and water. It just spans boundaries. It spans geopolitical boundaries. And so these consumption devices and these connected devices that draw our attention. So the business models have changed. You're not. So it's having this huge impact on the social fabric. And we at the museum feel like as a cornerstone institution, both from a collections perspective, but also from a physical location. We're a little more than a mile away from the laboratory space that Shockley had inventing the integrated circuit. And, you know, the coincidence of the social factors that led to Silicon Valley becoming what it is, as well as the geopolitical issues, right? If you think about where we came from in the 50s, coming out of World War II with rocketry and technologies of the day, frankly speaking, aerospace was in Los Angeles and in Seattle. The Russians had better rockets than we did. And Shockley, who was the inventor of the integrated circuit, decided to be in Palo Alto because that's where his mother was. He left L.A., and we had this high concentration of public-private partnerships in Silicon Valley feeding the semiconductor industry to reduce weight in the systems for rocketry. So the defense and sort of geopolitical issues. So we're in the same place today, I think, where as technology has leveled the playing field, where we have to have a new spirit of public, private, and social engagement with ethical considerations and moral responsibilities that I think the museum, in partnership with other institutions like Santa Clara, as well as, you know, many, you know, deep science institutions and domain experts on ethical issues, as well as, you know, governance and related structural issues, is fundamental. So there's a new citizenship responsibility. And I think the museum can play a part, as museums should, as a learning institution in conjunction with others. So I'm excited about the moment in time and the place physically, as well as the charter from which we can, you know, make our institution an important one, which is the computing past and decoding it is what we can be good at. But we have to partner with others to make those stories resonate with broad audiences. And there's no one in the world today who isn't affected by computing.
So it's interesting when I hear you talk about your time rolling out the Mac and that sort of that era, it really makes me think about that we were at another moment there where we really realized the remarkable potential of technology to help people. And yet, you know, now years later, we're sort of at this moment where we have seen some of the things that have gone wrong, right? And so can you think about some specific technology or innovations that you think produce some unintended consequences? What were the unintended consequences of technology over the past couple of decades, and what can we do now to address those?
Yeah, I'm an optimist, and I believe in the greater good of new technologies. I think in historical context gives us hope. The future is uncertain, right? But pick your favorite breakthrough, the wheel. Lots of people die in car accidents. They wouldn't if we didn't have wheels, right? But in general, mobility is a good thing. Wheels have turned into good things. Hammers, similarly, it's, you know, I love Habitat for Humanity, for example, but people get hurt with hammers. So I believe in general that technology and new technique goes beyond the zero-sum game, and that they'll be positive. The reflections today that I think are most fundamental get into the use of current computing architectures, because we're on the verge in the next decade of some fundamental breakthroughs in quantum computing and things like that, which will be, to coin sort of the Thomas Kuhn thing, sort of a paradigm shift. There will be some fundamental shifts. But as we know it today, it's so much of it is tied to the business models. And the concern, you know, that I have is the attention-based business models. And the fundamental way that, if you will, propaganda has, and it is propaganda, has manipulated and isolated smaller groups of people to kind of breathe their own air. And that is a real unintended consequence. I think that the people who pioneered this industry, microprocessor-based and the content-less creation, if you will, of the personal computer era, from the microprocessor to PCs to, you know, leading up to the Y2K period of nearly, you know, 20 years ago, sort of the big breakthrough in everyone in the internet, you know, basically most people having access. And then these small handheld devices that are basically attention-based business models. That's my worry, because they're addicting and there's really a need for a re-education, if you will. So I think there's which is where I think the museum, educational institutions, and in general, some level of regulatory oversight is reasonably important. And we're in the middle of it, so it's really hard to figure out from my standpoint to actually put a fine point on what the solution is, because it's very complicated, but there are lots of people talking about it. And, you know, it does go back in the modern world, if you will, of going back to the Industrial Revolution. It goes back to some really interesting work that Tim Wu wrote about, and The Attention Merchants is a really wonderful read. And how those, you know, in this last century, 100 years ago, you know, the British government did a really good job of you know, pointing a finger at the young men that they needed for fodder for trench warfare, and saying the Queen needs you, right? And then we did a really good job, Uncle Sam wants you, in World War II. And in between that period of time, frankly, Adolf Hitler perfected it with the brown shirts and training young people for those very reasons, to not think with a moral compass, if you will. So the campaigning technology was very eye-opening for me. And anyway, I could talk more about that if you'd like, my experience and what happened in the last election cycle. But to me, it's just a struggle with the business model concerns.
So, Daniel, one of the many other things that you're involved in is an accelerator, as am I, at Santa Clara. Yours is StartX at Stanford. How do you, when you're looking at new technology innovations, how do you incorporate the ideas of inclusion, equity, and justice into the evaluation of them? And you know, you said earlier that you're an optimist, but lots of technologies have beneficial uses and uses that aren't so good. What do you do when you're mentoring and directing younger CEOs to think about how they can focus on the beneficial uses and not have these unintended consequences?
It's an interesting filter, and there are some in the financing community that are thinking about that. One of the partners at Mayfield Partners, Tim Chang, is pretty vocal about that. We moderated a panel with Tim and Craig Newmark from Craigslist, who's been, you know, contributing a lot philanthropically to addressing some of these issues. And obviously coming from Craigslist and the implications on Craigslist as well, it's sort of an interesting sort of social fabric issue. Well, you know, my involvement at StartX is tied to the fact that as they were kickstarting that program, it was two Stanford students, PhD students, and you know, they were building curricula for training and building these cohorts, et cetera. I'm not so deeply involved in the selection of the entrepreneurs there, and it's been, frankly speaking, 6 or 7 years since I did a lot of mentoring work with the entrepreneurs. But their filter does factor in some strong uses of technology for healthcare. So their involvement at Stanford is tied both to the broader, if you will, quote unquote, computer science and related technical disciplines in that vein, if you will, computer science, electrical engineering. But a lot of it is tied to the the medical center as well, and research in that area, big data and analytics. So, you know, my enthusiasm for staying involved as a fiduciary and a board member is to help them, you know, maintain this nonprofit status as an incubator. And where, what I get to listen and learn from as opposed to mentor is the interesting things coming out of the medical center, because I'm a big believer in energy, health, and education as the way out, and the investment frameworks by which we move society forward in a better way.
Are there particular technologies or innovations you see on the radar now that you think will have the greatest impact? I mean, we hear about all kinds of things, material science, metal organic frameworks, quantum computing, AI, synthetic biology. A lot of those have really beneficial uses, but also maybe some uses that aren't so good, especially when living in the time of pandemic and some of the rumors proven to be false by science. I think that was something that got out of a lab in China. But how do you think about which technologies excite you the most in terms of advancing social justice?
Yeah, I think the deep neural nets and the deep learning techniques that can be targeted for specific use can readjust supply chain and quote unquote manufacturing or production capabilities. I'm excited about the possibilities in food and optimization of farming. We're not going to do away with agribusiness tomorrow at scale. But I also think that optimizing some of the farming technologies is going to be interesting. Ideally, we can get into a level of education and learning as well. As you know, as the systems can be tuned, my favorite analogy is a little bit like we have these systems in our phones or in our cars. Invariably, they're in our phones these days to reroute if you take a wrong turn when you're in your car, and it reroutes. Well, you know, it's one thing to feel good about getting 80 or 85% right in algebra in eighth grade if you're, you know, if that's the place where you take algebra. But it's another thing to miss the 15% that make a difference in your future, even though you got your B+. And so rerouting and making sure that people really have the fundamentals and having a little more tuned learning environment, I'm hopeful and optimistic for that. I'm less specifically tuned into the material science things, but the built infrastructure, when you start to think about Internet of Things in major metros, one of my areas of interest and work at Microsoft in the end was we had six cities within which we were focused on the approach by which a company like Microsoft could engage in built infrastructure conversations. And Chicago was our quote unquote first city, kind of a strong mayoral office by definition. Chicago always has been that way, as opposed to sort of a city manager's or city council style, and massive built infrastructure that's 100 years old or so. And how do you retool those things in such a way that, you know, the energy within the context of these old buildings is appropriately managed and considered. So there's an abundance of things that exist in the built infrastructure where material science and AI-based techniques can really solve a lot of problems. And in some cases, you have to run experiments to figure out what those things look like. So I see lots of opportunity for experimentation. And then ideally, again, I'm hopeful about a broader scale set of moonshot-like initiatives. Pick your favorite one. Frankly, I got to know Jay Inslee pretty well when I was working at Microsoft because I had the environmental sustainability agenda, and companies based in Washington, consumes a lot of energy in Washington, and got to know him. And I thought his platform, as he was, at least for a brief time, running campaigning for president, but his platform of having a targeted framework within which just about everything cascades from education to infrastructure and all the rest, is a way to organize with first principles, you know, federal scale resources that can then cascade into the states and let the governors and local municipalities take advantage of those agendas. And it can happen everywhere locally. It's not like it could has to be concentrated, because technology is, again, pervasive, and applying these neural nets and deep learning techniques and AIs can be done in rural parts. It doesn't have to be a new, kind of a new Silicon Valley place. Take those concepts and scale them everywhere.
Yeah. So that's really, really an interesting comment. And I think looking at the arc of computer history, we went from big, you know, centralized computers. I remember my brothers and I talking and reading science fiction, and there was the ENIAC and these giant computers, to we've all got computers everywhere in the world now. And as you talked about, computing is incredibly distributed globally. It can happen pretty much anywhere and very interoperable. But some of the other systems and the old infrastructure that you described, energy and food or two that come to mind, are pretty centralized. And we have this massive monoculture in the United States going on that requires a huge amount of inputs, and agriculture is one of the major contributors to greenhouse gas emissions and global warming, which Jay Inslee also talked a lot about. And energy is also still very, very centralized and not refractory to major events like the fires that we had up here last year and a couple of years ago in Sonoma County or other natural disasters. So do you see a general arc of, you know, I think it was in Science Magazine a couple of weeks ago, of granular technologies as a way to transform things from centralized to incredibly local? When you think about distributed energy systems or local food production, we would save a lot of energy by growing. And obviously, you can't grow everything everywhere. I'm not going to grow bananas in my backyard. Well, maybe 3 or 4 years from now, I will be able to with climate change. But can you talk a little bit about sort of this, you know, granular technologies versus centralized, and how you see advances there shifting systems?
Yeah, I think you said that well. There's a lot that's being pioneered, and some even venture-backed for, you know, optimized farming. I don't know the terms. I'm not tracking it specifically, but, you know, on relatively small acreage, you know.
Right, like regenerative agriculture.
Yeah, regenerative agriculture. And so there's a lot going on there. Additive manufacturing, you know, these, you can 3D print a meaningful tiny home in a day. This company in San Francisco doing that right now, and pioneering work in other parts of the country. But you start to think about even some of the new regulations about these what do they call them, granny units or whatever. There's this additive, you know, the smaller units on existing properties that are for housing concerns. I think that's you know, really important. We're in a place where things can be localized. There's, for the most part, no reason. There will need to be some regulatory oversight on some of those things, but I think it's very doable, and I expect that in the next, particularly coming out of, I mean, where we sit today, I mean, we're all somewhat shell-shocked in the moment. Every day we wake up and it's like Groundhog Day, and so many different, it's like, all right, here we are, and then there's a new scenario that of the way the world's going to emerge. And we learn hour to hour in some cases, or day to day, and change opinions based upon that. So I do think the ability to accelerate the way people think and what's socially acceptable or some new normal, rather than taking 10 years, which is that adage of, you know, gee, it's we always over anticipate what could be done in the immediate term and then under anticipate what happens in the longer term. That's going to get concentrated, and we'll see what happens 2 or 3 years from now on those fronts. Energy, I just think, I mean, if I wave a magic wand and I read the tea leaves from Tesla and Elon Musk, they're not a car company. That's an energy distribution company, right? I mean, the wind blows and the energy somewhere else. You capture the energy. They're building trucks because you got to move the energy around because it's a storage problem. So you store it in a battery. You put it on a truck that's electric, and the trucks are daisy chained together with 5G related technologies, and you move the energy to where you need it. You know, and it's, you're not in the railroad business if you're Shell Oil, you're in the energy distribution business. And so, you know, those bays to lift cars up to change the oil, you just lift them up and swap a battery in, you know, or it's, I think there are scenario planners at places like Shell thinking about that. And Shell's got a multi-billion-dollar investment engine that's trying to put Shell out of business, if you will. I mean, they're in the business they're in, and they have certain responsibilities. I even see corporate governance when you talk about that. There's lots of talk about corporate governance and how you measure, you know, the returns, if you will, on a societal scale rather than just a capital scale. So I see a lot more conversations occurring that will, I think, be radically accelerated as a result of where we're sitting today, 6, 8 weeks, 10 weeks, 3 months into a crisis, depending upon where you start. And it's conversations like what you're doing at the university. I mean, the ethical framework by which the institution exists, given its very nature, but then the centers of excellence that you've created over these last few decades are ever more important. And again, you know, back to the museum, I think we have a teeny little role to play within that context, because we're the source of, you know, the stories and the artifacts that brought this about, because we wouldn't have these problems in some respects without this level of automation, you know, without the transportation infrastructure and aerospace and all those other things. You know, it's, or the food systems and the monocultures that get created as a result of those things. We have to go back to some basics, and we're learning. I mean, gut biology and health is just another area that we're learning so much about as well. And it's all based on these new technologies.
This has been really fascinating. And you're obviously thinking about technology in very, very broad ways. And I like the framing that you use, the temporal framing of
the past of what's happened, the present, and then the future, what we're going to do. What is one thing you would like, whether they're future entrepreneurs or CEOs, whether they're students, supporters of Santa Clara University, the general public, what should we all be thinking about with respect to technology and how we evaluate emergent technologies?
Well, I think if you have the ability to, you know, build an advisory framework that's cross-discipline, it's always particularly important to bring in alternative viewpoints, recognizing that in most cases we are dealing with global opportunity applied locally. You know, a combination of thinking about diversity and transparency is really key. I'm a believer that it's sort of the first 5 years of life. I mean, you want to be thinking about others the way you'd like to be treated for the most part. And you know, you see the enthusiasm with which you kind of the counterculture helps stimulate the personal computer industry. John Markoff has written a fair amount about that and others as well. You know, and if you talk to some of the people from that era, and I was kind of on the if you will, the tail end, or got brought along in that period, there was, you know, great enthusiasm and optimism, but a little naivete in terms of the unintended consequences. And, you know, I think today we have the ability to see further and more broadly sooner in the cycle. That's the thing that I would encourage people to be thinking about is, and we see more of it going on in health and investments in food infrastructure and in industries around learning and education. And then I think the big swing, I mentioned Tesla, but I think energy kind of drives so much of it, because there's so much money in the energy sector. It's, you know, it's so fundamental. In health, you could pick one or the other as the key driver, because that is the thing that bifurcates our society, if you think in a U.S.-centric kind of way, is access to healthcare and the cost associated with healthcare. It's the one overlay that, you know, large companies and manufacturer insurance goes along with those things. So I'm a believer that those three areas would be the ones.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us a bit today.
Sure. No, this is a treat. I mean, I feel fortunate, as we all do, I think probably all those listening as well, that we are where we are at this moment in time. And it's also, I appreciate you sort of following along on some of my wanderings, because like everyone else, my focus is it's deep on the museum, and I'm also the chair of the Silicon Valley Community Foundation, which is the regional distribution point for the 9-county Bay Area for some fundamental relief funds. And that also takes time.
Thank you very much, Daniel. Probably no time more important than right now during this pandemic to imagine ways technology can accelerate the greater good.
Yeah, we have to be hopeful, that's for sure.
Thank you very much. I'm Thane Kreiner, Executive Director of Miller Center. You've been listening to Line of Sight.
And I'm Don Heider, Executive Director of the Markle Center at Santa Clara. Thanks for listening.